You're listening to Open for Discussion, a University of Sydney podcast that discusses research through a personal and critical lens. I'm your host, Chris Neff. In 2015, my guest won accolades for his research on how the word, huh, is essential to human communication. They built on that research to show that no 5 minutes of conversation go by in any language without someone attempting to fix a misunderstanding. So from studying how we strive to understand each other with precision, I'm intrigued to know how our guest is now a member of a research initiative examining how fake news, alternative facts, lies, and propaganda are spread and how we detect them. Professor Nick Enfield is Chair of Linguistics at the University of Sydney and Director of the Sydney Social Science and Humanities Advanced Research Center. Thank you for joining us today, Professor Enfield.
Thank you for having me.
Nick, it seems a long way from field work in Laos examining fake news. How did studying linguistics get you here?
Well, you'd be surprised. I think it's not actually that far away. My interest in linguistics really sort of was, you know, kindled through seeing my professors go out into the field and do research on endangered languages. And so that was exciting to me, the idea that you could travel across the world and go to a very different type of society and culture and see how people speak there. And once you're doing that, well, you see language from the point of view of its social utility, not just to convey information, but to create alliances and to get things done. And to the problem of truth is right at the core of that, really, or at least it's a crucial element of that. Political language and the language, of sort of media and that kind of thing operates on much higher scales. But deep down, it's all, to me, the same stuff.
I love this stuff. Before we talk about deliberate misunderstandings in language, I'd like to discuss the work you've done, Nick, that points to just how much subtle negotiation or adjustments take place to understand each other in one-on-one conversations, this 90-second threshold. Do you mind explaining that a bit?
I think actually the precise figure is 84 seconds, but, you know, it's much of a muchness. About every 90 seconds on average across the languages of the world in free-flowing conversations, someone will say something like, huh, what, who? This kind of a question that gets the other person to back up and either repeat or clarify or rephrase what they just said. You know, this is a fairly remarkable statistic in a number of ways. I mean, one, it shows that language is far from perfect, that actually a lot of the time we don't quite succeed. What it also shows us, though, is that people are willing to help the other person by backing up and doing the required repetition and the required sort of rephrasing and so on. And this points to a strong theme in a lot of the work that I've done, which is that language usage is a form of cooperation, and there's a true sort of core of cooperation in language usage. And it's essential to human cognition and to the way that humans interact. So it's not the case that in some languages people ask for clarification, you know, all the time, every 10 seconds, and in other languages they do it maybe every 10 minutes. You just don't get that. You get across the languages which we've looked at, which is from quite a broad sample around the world, a very similar sort of rate and set of strategies for doing these kinds of requests for clarification.
I love the idea of conversational repair, that there is this dance that's going on when people are having a conversation, and, you know, every 84 seconds or so, they're figuring out what the other person's saying, and that that's a universal principle that's applied across languages. This is really profound information, and I saw that you won the Ig Nobel Prize for this at Harvard University. How was that experience?
That experience was really interesting in a whole range of ways. So the Ig Nobel Prize, it's for research that first makes you laugh and then makes you think. And the prize was for a finding from a large project that all languages that we have evidence for have the same word, huh, for, you know, you have no idea what the person just said in any way at all. And we found that in every language we looked at, one word that people could use to do that is huh, the same sound occurring in all these languages, which is remarkable because languages normally have very different sounding words for the same types of objects or the same types of functions. Later on, we found these other much more nuanced findings about things like the 90-second threshold. You know, my understanding of that prize before we won it was that it is kind of jokey, right? It's a kind of parody prize in a way. You know, on the one hand, you feel like, yeah, you don't really want to win that, right? Because it's sort of making fun of your work and this type of thing. It's actually become prestigious. So yeah, it was really exciting to win that, and it was obviously great for our research that it's given this project a lot more of a profile, and it I think it was very good for the subsequent work that came out.
On this, I love this stuff. Can I go down the rabbit hole with you for a moment here?
Sure thing.
Because if, from what I read, when you looked at languages, this also included sign language.
That's right.
I don't know why my brain went here, but it went to like Coco the ape, like Michael Jackson's ape that learned sign language. If humans teach sign language to animals, then would that or the conversational repair translate into their vocabulary as well?
Yeah, that's a good question. It's one that would seem natural to ask. And the answer that I give is a definite no, that animals will not use a signal like huh, and there's a very particular reason for it. So, you know, animal communication systems are very complex in a whole range of ways, and, you know, there's visual signals and there's vocal signals and there's all manner of signals. But most of the time, those signals are sort of broadcast. Maybe they were directed at another individual, or maybe they were just directed at whoever happened to be looking, you know, or listening, as in a bird's sort of territorial call or what have you. But what you never see in animal forms of communication is a truly cooperative type of exchange. You know, this is exactly what's exemplified by the huh type phenomenon. So when I say huh, you don't just keep going on talking, right? You will cooperate with me by backing up and saying what you just said again. So there's this sort of real high-level cooperation that takes place there. And so even in animals that have something that looks a little bit like turn-taking, so there are various primate species, and birds also have something that looks like a turn-taking system. Yeah, you never get this kind of possibility of one saying something like, huh? So turning to the sign language question that you asked, teaching a primate, an ape, to use signs is not the same as teaching them to use sign language. So mm-hmm. they're able to use signs, and sometimes in interesting ways they might combine those in similar ways to a child of between 1 and 2 years of age might do, you know, or something like that. But there's nothing like the sophistication in those cases of an ape using signs, nothing like the sophistication that you find in human sign language.
So, Nick, can I ask just a really basic question? Do you have a favorite word? Can you tell us what your favorite word is and why?
That's a kind of typical question that a linguist would be asked. What's your favorite word? No, I like it, though. I mean, we can talk about it. So one answer would be, you know, I love the word huh, for the reasons we've been talking about. You know, but of course, there are plenty of other sorts of ones. So I was recently on a panel discussing correct grammar and correct punctuation and proper words and this kind of thing. And one of the members of the audience was complaining about the lack of distinctions that were being made by, you know, young people today. And the example that came to mind to sort of counter that was to say, well, let's take another example where in English, second person pronoun, the you, doesn't distinguish between singular and plural. So if I say you don't know if I mean one person or multiple people. And use, you know, in American dialects, you got you all or y'all. Use actually is a form that makes an important meaning distinction. And so, you know, I as I was talking about this, I thought, well, I like that word. I think that word does, you know, it does something really nice. So that would be one kind of word that might be my favorite one. But I think that on any given day, you know, there could be a million words. So,
well, since you picked a semi-American word, I'm going to pick a semi-Australian word. I was walking down King Street in Newtown, and there was one guy walking toward me with a bike with a flat tire, and his friend is walking next to me, And he goes, what happened to your bike? And the guy goes, flat tire. And the other guy goes, Devo. And the other guy goes, Devo. And I've got to say, Devo is one of my favorite words. And it's, I know it's an Australian abbreviation, but I'm just going to go there, that Devo won my heart sort of immediately.
That's great. Words, if words win your heart, then, you know, that's good for the linguist in all of us.
So where do you look when a linguist is looking to find out about a language? Where do they look?
Well, it all depends on what aspect of the language you want to look at and which language it is. So when you come to languages that are not actually written down and that are spoken by much smaller communities and that haven't really been studied before, what they have to do is to collect the language data themselves. Now, that's not a very easy thing to do. And so what's traditionally been taught is to go into the field, get to know the people that you're working with, and ask them to tell some narratives, and then you record those narratives. So for example, a person might say, tell you the story of their life, and you get this monologue, and then you transcribe it, and then you sit down with people who speak the language, and you find out, okay, what does this word mean? What does this word mean? What does this sort of structure, how does that work? And that's the sort of typical way of working in doing sort of, you know, linguistic field work. And there's a really major blind spot in that. I mean, it's just very few people have gone out and collected recordings of conversation, that is real dialogue back and forth, you know, not staged, but just everyday conversation, which in fact is far and away the most common sort of mode of using language. It's actually when you look at free-flowing conversation that you see these things that animals just don't do. And secondly, because that order actually does tell us something quite important about what is essential to the human capacity for language. And that is, after all, what linguists are looking for.
So can we go from negotiating and talking about individual communication to mass communication? Because I'm interested in research that you're doing. And I'm wondering what the aims are of the Post-Truth Initiative.
The Post-Truth Initiative is a Sydney Research Excellence Initiative joined by a number of colleagues from areas, you know, from physics to media and communications to philosophy to government and international relations and the Sydney Environment Institute. There's a whole range of people involved. For us as academics and as scientists, as people who are trying to find out how the world is and to discover new things and to come to new knowledge, you know, after we've learnt new things about the world through our work, then we want to make impact from that, right? We want that to affect policy or practice, or we want that to lead to further discovery. So it matters to us that the facts that we arrive at through our work are actually treated as facts. As well as that, many of my colleagues in, for example, politics and in media, they're interested in the concepts of truth themselves and in the sort of power dynamics surrounding truth and all that kind of thing. So what we're really doing is studying the problem that seems to be rearing its head right now globally in public discourse, that truth and empirical findings and evidence have less weight than they used to. But we're also, through studying that, trying to understand, well, how could we then, you know, counteract it? Because
well, and it sounds like this goes back to the point you were making about the way individual communication works, in that we're each accountable to each other for the words that we say and the way that we communicate and making sure that the other person understands. Just a quick language warning, that you're trying to build a bullshit detector? Is that correct?
That's right. We are. We're trying to build a bullshit detector. It is a, essentially what we're interested in doing is exploring ways in which new information technology and AI in the area of sort of language processing, speech recognition, that kind of thing. I mean, this is a field that is moving very, very quickly. One sort of thing that we're focusing on right now is looking for inconsistencies over time in how certain individuals have spoken about certain topics. So, for example, politicians speaking about coal and what they've said about the reef itself and what they've said about climate change and these kinds of things, then we can see, well, okay, here's a person who's been quite consistent, or here's a person who's flip-flopped back and forth like crazy. And that, in a way, is a kind of measure of, well, what we're regarding as bullshit, kind of technically defined. So you asked about the question of accountability and the kind of relationship between, you know, my area of work on the kind of micro level of interaction and the kinds of things that I was just talking about in relation to how politicians have spoken over time and that kind of thing. And you're absolutely right to point to accountability as being the key kind of factor there. We expect, when people say things to us, that they're telling the truth, right? And that's what makes lying, mm-hmm. that's what makes lying a possible thing that might work, because it exploits that fact. It exploits the fact that people assume that we're telling the truth. Just telling falsehoods like that in your everyday life, you will find yourself being held accountable to them in a pretty major way. And, you know, whole relationships can break down around things like that very quickly. So the issue about kind of scaling up to political discourse and to the media and all that kind of thing, that doesn't really change in terms of, you know, how our brains are oriented. And that's kind of the big part of the problem here. And that is that we have the same levels of trust in the individuals that we're kind of listening to, like a politician talking or you know, an author that's written a blog post that we're reading or whatever. We apply that same level of trust as we would sort of in everyday interaction, which is where, you know, all of these capacities kind of evolved. And as we all know, with a system like the one that we have, with the information revolution being what it is, then we can abuse that trust very, very easily, and there's very little the rest of us can do about it. So, you know, I think at the core of it, for me, that's the problem. And I think that kind of lack of trust and cynicism and so forth about politicians and so on, which is, you know, surprising that hasn't happened a lot earlier. You know, it really does make sense. And I think people are tapping into the fact that those people who are making decisions that affect all of us are just completely distant from us. We have no way of knowing what they really mean and so forth. So that in a way destroys the currency of truth and trust. And so I suspect there's a kind of collapse of that currency going on that's a little bit like the collapse of a monetary currency in a society where people have lost their faith in that.
Oh God, that was a depressing answer to the question.
Sorry.
No, that's fine. It's politics as usual. And that brings me to my final question, which is the way language boundaries stabilize ethnic boundaries. Could you give us a quick outline of that research and its applications? Because I've heard that this is another area that you're working on.
I work in Laos, and it's like many countries that are not far from the equator. It's a place that has a lot of linguistic diversity, which is to say there are many different languages spoken in a small area of land. And these languages are spoken by people of different ethnic identities. And so, you know, usually we think of a language as sort of being attached to a certain ethnic identity. And what I'm interested in looking at here is what happens when you have actually quite small languages being spoken together in communities where there's a lot of social interaction between those communities. So in the area that we're going to be working in sort of upland area of central Laos, you've got quite small language communities of about, let's say, 300 speakers of one language and maybe 1,000 speakers of another language and maybe 2,000 speakers of another language, villages that are sort of just 1 hour's walk from each other. So you have groups of people who are meeting each other every day on the paths and in the fields and so forth, and they're visiting each other's houses. And actually the languages that they speak in Laos have, over time, they've come to resemble each other very, very closely in terms of their structure, even though they're not historically related to each other. And so the question is, how do you maintain your ethnic distinction while at the same time sort of letting your language gravitate more and more closely to the language of the other group? So we're really sort of looking at the dynamics of that. If you check back in with us in about 3 years' time, I'll tell you how the project went.
I would love to. Well, I learned a lot today, and I really appreciate our conversation. So thank you again, Professor Nick Enfield from the University of Sydney.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for joining us on Open for Discussion. If you'd like to know more about our research, be sure to visit our website, sydney.edu.au/news.